Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For our listeners in the Black Hills, KYSD 91.9 FM in Spearfish is going off the air at 10:30 Mountain Time for tower maintenance. We don't know how long it's going to be down at this point. We apologize for that inconvenience. In the meantime, you can listen via our live web stream at sdpb.org or via our smartphone app. Thank you for your patience during this season of tower work. And on to In the Moment. What makes a successful presidency? How soon should we judge the mark a president makes on the nation? How does a president's legacy change once viewed through the lens of history and perspective? Professor Sean Flynn is a history and political science professor at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. He recently participated in the five-day 20th Century Presidency Seminar, and he lived to tell about it. Sean Flynn joins us from Mitchell. Welcome.
Thanks, Lori. Good to be back.
Tell us about this seminar, how you ended up being selected for it. It sounds like quite an honor.
Yeah, it really was. It was a competitive process. There were 120 applicants from around the country and some international applicants as well. They selected the committee that was made up of representatives of the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History and the Council of Independent Colleges, selected 30 academics from around the country and from four foreign nations. The moderator for the seminar was Professor Emeritus at UCLA, Robert Dalek. And Professor Dalek is closely connected with the Stanford and Washington program, which is this ongoing program that brings Stanford University students about 25 a year to Washington, D.C. to examine the presidency and other institutions of government. About half of us were historians, half of us were political scientists, which made for a lot of interesting discussion because we approached the presidency differently. Historians tend to be more interested in the person in the office. Political scientists are far more interested in the institution. But that made for some really rich conversation. Our task over the 5 days was to explore qualities or characteristics of 20th century presidential leadership, to devise some evaluative criteria, you might say, for examining or assessing or evaluating the success of a presidency or the effectiveness of a president. So we kind of came up with this rubric, if you will, or this template or this model. And that included six different criteria that we applied for the most part to the presidencies of Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. But the backdrop of being in Washington, D.C. and, you know, President Trump's presidency was never far from our mind, nor were recent presidents such as George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and others. So some of the criteria your listeners might be interested in this, you know, what when historians or political scientists evaluate the success of a presidency, you know, what are some of the criteria involved with that? Vision, you know, we expect a president as American citizens to have a particular vision and to be able to articulate that, to communicate that effectively to the mass of American citizens. So we want to know clearly what direction the president is taking us. And I think Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Johnson were all effective at that, as were other presidents. We want our president to be pragmatic, to be flexible, to be able to adjust to changing conditions in the country, whether that's a crisis or just changing social, economic, cultural, political consequences or conditions in the country. We expect, I think, as American citizens, for our president to have some degree of charisma, or at least the ability to persuade us, some power of personal persuasion. I don't view LBJ as a particularly charismatic president, but he had a way of conveying to the American people and the members of Congress specifically his agenda, and he persuaded a lot of people to get a very robust legislative legacy established through that. Trust and credibility are important. We want our president to be honest. We want him to be reliable, credible. He means what he says. He says what he means. And then lastly, we expect our president to be able to build consensus, to reach beyond his base, to knit together coalitions that are representative of the American public, a broader American public than just those voters who sent it into Washington, D.C. And using that rubric, if you will, that list of criteria, we began to examine how effective Roosevelt, Kennedy, and Johnson were in achieving these and being successful with these in these areas, in these criteria areas, and then began to examine other presidents as well.
What about the notion of making a difference long term, where you can look back 20 years later, 40 years later, and say, we have this because, you know, we talk about the national parks, we think Teddy Roosevelt. Does that fit in at all, that the president would have a legacy that lasted beyond his or her presidency?
Oh, absolutely. If you think about just slogans, the way presidents will try to articulate their vision or communicate their vision through a slogan. Some of these slogans are permanent parts of our political consciousness. FDR's New Deal remains with us, the social welfare net that's part of our lives, a day-to-day part of our social and political and economic fabric. Harry Truman had his Fair Deal. John F. Kennedy inspired us and asked us to look at the world before us as a new frontier to be conquered. Space was to be conquered. American values were to be spread around the globe, and American influences were to be felt on this new frontier. Medicare and Medicaid and the Great Society—it's part of our legacy now. It's Johnson's legacy. It's part of our the fabric of our daily lives. And Ronald Reagan, his idea of American values and a city on a hill—all of these are examples, I think, of presidential legacy and of presidents being able to communicate well. How they want American people to feel. Their vision for improving the lives of American or raising the stature of American influence overseas. And affecting change, whether domestically or internationally, their ability to articulate that is so important. And I think we can have a debate about what presidents in recent American history are really good at that. If you ask the general public, who they believe was particularly effective and whose legacy has had an impact on their lives, they tend to rate John F. Kennedy very highly. His approval rating in a poll last year was about 85%. Mm. Ronald Reagan was kind of a distant second. So Americans today still see Kennedy as impacting them, inspiring them, and pointing them toward a way that they wanted America to be seen as in the world. Those are some examples, historical examples of legacy, I think.
Are people willing then to overlook a president's shortcomings, such as with JFK, not only in a personal realm, but in, in policymaking realm as well?
What was really interesting in the seminar is the younger academics were much more inclined toward overlooking some of those personal foibles or those black marks or stains on the president, on a particular presidential administration, and to look at things like legislative achievements or regulatory reforms. For instance, I found it interesting that a lot of the younger scholars want to study Richard Nixon in a vacuum. They don't want to apply the Watergate label to him. They'd rather look at what he achieved legislatively. What were some of his foreign policy accomplishments? And then, apply the heavy weight and the stain, if you will, the black mark of Watergate to that. I was also struck by a lot of the younger scholars were very impressed with the George H.W. Bush presidency. He's a dignified man who was very well prepared for the office of the presidency, who had to wrestle with the collapse of the Soviet Union and what that meant internationally, how weapons of mass destruction were now quote unquote on the market as the USSR collapsed, how Bush, H.W. Bush cobbled together an alliance in the Gulf War, how he nudged public opinion to support the Gulf War. And it was just interesting, these scholars in their late 20s and 30s who may not have any living memory of these presidents. Well, they don't have any living memory of Richard Nixon, and they likely don't have any living memory of George H.W. Bush, but they examine their legacies and they want a little bit, they don't want my generation or older telling them how to feel about a particular president. People who lived through Vietnam or Watergate have a visceral response, maybe, or a visceral reaction to Lyndon Johnson or to Richard Nixon. Since they have no living memory of that, they want to judge those presidencies more in a vacuum.
What do you make of that then? Is that an advantage as one of the scholars of an earlier generation? Did you look at that and say, there's something to that, to sort of take away some of these things? Or did you think, hey, don't judge this in a vacuum. You can't wipe away Vietnam. You can't wipe away Watergate.
I see it as an advantage in the sense that they really are being detached from the moment. They're almost in a laboratory, exploring the presidency in a laboratory. I mean, if you ask us, Lori, about a particular president whose life we've experienced, our reaction might be tainted by one singular event or a comment or some kind of event that took place during that presidency, and it kind of colors the way we look at the presidency. I see some of these younger scholars wanting to be more scientific in their study of the presidency. Certainly, we want older scholars to remind them of the impact, the lasting impact that Vietnam had, how it seared the public consciousness, how it affected foreign policy for decades, how it shaped other nations' view of the United States. We certainly want them to understand how Watergate tore the country apart and divided the country, and how it's become this landmark event in American history where we no longer have trust in the presidency the way we once did. We no longer, we're more suspicious of or cynical about the presidency. So we certainly want students in the classroom to know that if you've experienced this, it gives you a particular kind of an insight or an advantage. On the other hand, I like this idea of a more detached scientific exploration of the president. Otherwise, the popular press and popular public opinion can stain a presidency create this kind of expectation on what we should be thinking about when we study that presidency, which colors our interpretation of that presidency. I used All the President's Men in a class last spring. I wanted the students to know about Watergate, which they didn't know a lot about. But rather than tell them what Watergate did to the nation, let them on their own determine whether they thought this was a crime, a high crime, and to what degree Richard Nixon should have been punished, or to what degree we should still be fixated on Watergate. And it was refreshing. It was very refreshing for the students and for younger scholars to examine the presidency that way.
What kind of insight did they have, though? Because it's not just Watergate itself. It's sort of, the aides thinking he's unhinged. It's his depression. It's all kinds of things that are happening at the same time, sort of connected with Watergate.
Certainly. And any good professor who's studying recent American history and is studying that chapter on Watergate wants the student to know about the psychological makeup of Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. But we should want them to know about the psychological makeup of any president. One of the reasons Professor Dalek's book on JFK was such a big hit, he wrote, some of your listeners who read presidential biographies might be familiar with Professor Dalek's book called An Unfinished Life, which was on JFK. One of the things that we learned in that book, because he had access to Kennedy's medical records, is, wow, this man took a lot of drugs, prescription drugs. He had so many doctors distributing so much medicine that one doctor didn't know what the other doctor was using. And we want students to know that, because if we're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, for instance, what frame of mind was John F. Kennedy in during the Cuban Missile Crisis? If he's doped up to treat his Addison's disease and his terrible back pain, did that affect his judgment? Did it affect his judgment and any other thing? The Bay of Pigs, the Vienna Conference with Khrushchev, these other kind of watershed events of his administration, was he? So certainly we want students to evaluate that. But legacy, presidents' stature over time rises because they're compared to presidents who come after them. And some presidents are seen as doing a pretty good job. Truman's approval rating when he left office was 23%. It's the lowest recorded in American history. Now Harry Truman is considered one of the great presidents, because a lot of the people who began judging him in evaluating him didn't live through the Korean War. They didn't experience how the Korean War divided the nation or some of the corruption charges that came up that were levied against some of Truman's administration towards the end of his time in office. They didn't experience that. They're looking back on the impact that his decisions had on the world and the impact that his legislation had on the daily lives of Americans. That kind of detachment, I think, is essential.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Dakota Wesleyan University History and Science, Political Science Professor Sean Flynn, and we're talking about what he learned out of an intensive week in Washington, D.C. about the 20th Century Presidency Seminar. And Sean, I'm wondering how this informs how we evaluate our current president. When we look at President Donald Trump, should we try to keep a sense of distance from the day-to-day headlines and keep the big picture? Or is that something that really is only effective after there's a little bit of distance between us and the nitty-gritty of what's unfolding in our nation today?
Oh, no. I think we want to evaluate any president in the moment. And I think you can use the evaluative criteria I listed earlier to do that. For instance, Trump's communication style, his ability to articulate his agenda, his style, his particular communication style, the language, the rancor, some of the more coarse language he uses is unsettling and jarring and in many ways unprecedented in American history. On the other hand, his approach is not unprecedented. Every president hopes to make effective use of the bully pulpit, to be able to go over the head of Congress, go over the head of political elites, go around the press and speak directly to the American people, and in doing that, marshal support for their agenda or marshal public support on a particular issue. Political scientists refer to this as going public. The president says, I don't want anybody to filter my remarks. I want to go straight to the public. FDR was a genius at this. His fireside chats revolutionized the way the president talks to the people. Harry S. Truman's transcontinental whistle stop tour in 1948, in which he was told, "You can't beat Thomas Dewey." He says, "Oh yes, I can. I'm going to go out and I'm going to talk to the people." John F. Kennedy had an incredible skill at disarming reporters during press conferences. He was a charming guy. And if I ask your listeners to go back and look at a YouTube press conference from John F. Kennedy's administration, you know, he just quiets the press. And the next thing you know, and he's not talking to reporters, he's talking to you. I use Richard Nixon's famous Great Silent Majority speech as an example of how presidents can do that. So these and other examples I'm building to the point about Donald Trump. Donald Trump's attempting to do that same thing, to go public. And he's using tweets, and he's using this kind of combative language with the public. And it's a different style without question. It's a different medium that he's using. But his goal or objective is the same as FDR's or Truman's or anybody else's. And that is, he's going to boast about what he's doing well. He wants to maintain momentum for his agenda. And we as American citizens now have to decide if his language is presidential, is it dignified, is it soaring, is it measured, is it statesmanlike, or is it coarse, impoverished, you know, spiteful and incendiary, and how does that get in the way of him achieving his agenda? Is language, is the type of language he's using helping him? Is it assisting in achieving his legislative agenda, which he literally kind of has no legislative legacy yet? It's early on in his administration. We never know. Or is that language becoming something that's distracting us as American citizens? I would argue that I think we have an expectation, kind of like this genetic American expectation, where we expect the president to talk in certain kind of measured tones in a certain kind of a way. And Donald Trump's style certainly does not meet that. But at the same time, he's not using a tactic or a strategy that's any different, really, than FDR. It's just a different medium, a different form of technology to go public. I think the most important question we have to ask about the Trump presidency is, he capable of building a consensus? If that's one of the important evaluative criteria on successful presidencies, and I believe it is, you have to build beyond your base. You have to reach out and build a larger coalition. Is he capable of doing that? Does he want to do that? I think some of his advisors are arguing, you know what, we're looking at the electoral map. We got 35 to 40% of support. It's solid, 35 or 40%. We still think electorally we're in good shape. So maybe he's not interested in you know, broadening his appeal. It's perplexing. You know, why does he want to stay at this 35 to 40%? Because it's the lowest of any president this early in his administration in recorded history. And since we started to do polling, no president has had lower polling numbers at this point. So it's kind of perplexing why he's not trying to expand that base a little bit more. But maybe in his mind, doing that would be a sellout. You know, he was elected by these people. They brung him to Washington, and he's going to deliver for them. But
Do we value that building consensus as much as we used to, or is that, and do we value, I mean, you kind of mentioned the tweets and the coarseness, we'll say, of his language. Certainly that's the language he used as a candidate, and, you know, he won and made it to the presidency. Are we changing as a culture? And I guess what I'm really asking, the heart of my question, is the next American president, beyond President Donald Trump, will we be looking at people like that who are, you know, using a different language and going public
and that,
in a different way? And
that, Lori, is the $64,000 question. Mm-hmm. Is this the new norm?
Right.
Or is this an extraordinary event in American history? And I can't answer that question. I would say that the American public, turn on the television some night, watch a TV series, watch reality television, hang out around the water cooler at work. We are using more coarse language. We are speaking to each other in more combative ways. We are using more incendiary language, and we're more confrontational, and you can see that reflected, I believe, in our media and reflected in our culture and in the music we listen to. And so I think you're on to something, Lori, that maybe we've reached this point where presidential language might be changing, because the expectation is for the president to sound like, in some ways, the common person. On the other hand, the institution of the presidency is a very fragile thing, and we want to protect it. Mm. And we expect the president, and I think I speak for the majority of Americans and majority of South Dakotans, maybe I don't, but we want the president to raise us up. We want to hear soaring language. We want the president to speak in a dignified manner. Let me give you a couple examples. Donald Trump, his message to Congress, he stuck to the teleprompter. He stuck to the written speech, and when it was over, I was watching CNN, no lover of Donald Trump. When it was over, they were muzzled. They didn't know what to say. Wow, that was a good speech. You know, he stuck to the teleprompter. He gave a wonderful speech in Poland about a month ago, this uplifting speech about freedom and liberty, and America is kind of this beacon of freedom, of liberty. It was almost Reagan-esque sounding. He stuck to the teleprompter. And when he does that, he neutralizes the press. And you know, Donald Trump, he knows his popularity is greater than the media's popularity. The media as an institution in American society actually has a lower public approval rating than Trump. So sometimes I wonder why he's constantly fighting the press. At the same time, he can win the press over like Kennedy did. No one won the press over in this age of television like John F. Kennedy did. And I would, if I had 15 minutes with President Trump, I'd say, you know, you don't have to fight all these battles. You don't have to create all this confrontation with the press. You know, look back at how Kennedy kind of disarmed the press, whether he has those natural abilities that John F. Kennedy had, that charisma, that coolness. That's another story. But how many people do? You know, how many people have that naturally?
Sean Flynn is a history and political science professor at Dakota Wesleyan University. We've been talking about the 20th century presidency seminar, which he went to in Washington, D.C. Brings all that information back for his students at Dakota Wesleyan. Sean, come back anytime. We'll talk some more. Thanks for being here today.
I always enjoy talking to you, Lori. Some really great questions today, and have a great day.
All right, we'll see you next time.